Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Calling it modern-day book burning, best-selling authors sue Utah officials over book bans. Going without, here's what more than 120 Utahns taught me about getting by this past year. And the Great Salt Lake enters 2026 uncomfortably close to record lows. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Good to have you. Reporter Peyton Harkins is with us. Peyton, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Thank you. And water and land use reporter Leah Larson is with us. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, let's start with Carmen, education reporter. Here's the headline again, calling it modern-day book burning. Best-selling authors sue Utah officials over book bans. So, Carmen, who is this? Some best-selling authors are suing, and I guess what are they asking for?
Yeah. So this federal lawsuit is sort of led by best-selling authors, including Elena K. Arnold and Ellen Hopkins, both of whom have multiple titles that have been banned from public schools statewide, as well as two anonymous high school students. And the ACLU of Utah is representing the plaintiffs in this case. They're essentially alleging that Utah's sensitive materials law is unconstitutional because it violates the First Amendment rights of the students, while also preventing authors from reaching their intended audiences. And the basis for this is, one of the arguments for this is largely that Utah's law, which allows certain materials to be banned for pretty specific reasons, pretty much after it's banned for those reasons, it's kind of labeled as pornography. Like, legally, the law treats it no differently. Part of the argument here is that it's harming authors' reputations by putting this false label, according to the lawsuit, on these books.
Let's give some examples. For example, Elena K. Arnold, people may be familiar with What Girls Are Made Of and Damsel. And she says, we do not live in a world where no one experiences sexual assault, gaslighting, or abuse. Those are some themes in her books, right? So what did evaluators take issue with in those books?
Yeah, so if somebody challenges a book, it goes through a review process on the local level. And what essentially they're looking for is, does it amount to objective sensitive material? And that can include any depiction or description of intercourse, masturbation, genital touching. Nudity is described or defined as anything less than completely and opaquely covering human genitals. Like I said, there's some specific things that are being looked at. And what our law does is allow sort of any description or depiction of human sexuality to be challenged as objective sensitive material. And what this lawsuit argues is that while our law does say that when reviewing these materials, literary value and all of these things should be considered, the lawsuit is arguing, well, actually, it doesn't really allow all those other things to be considered, because any sort of description of human sexuality could lead to a book ban. Like, it doesn't matter within context, like literary context or not.
Now, there are other standards, other states, other areas use I guess, some standards that had been used, I guess, in Utah before. American Library Association had some standards. And then there's something called the Miller for Minors standard. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at, is what this lawsuit is claiming. So the standard is essentially the Supreme Court's way of defining obscene material, defining what is actually pornographic, which is not protected under free speech laws. So what is considered is literary merit, educational value, and age appropriateness. And so all things considered, all of that considered, if those things exist under those, I guess, three sort of standards, then it is not pornography. And so that's kind of the lawsuit does reference that. And it does say that we are banning materials without considering those things.
So I guess that age appropriateness, right? Context, the plaintiffs who bring this are saying we're missing this with Utah's law.
Yeah, I mean, one argument they make is that the books getting banned, they're award-winning works. And while not all the topic, like The Bluest Eye, for example, these are Nobel Prize winning works, and they have been recognized widely and have received like Presidential Medal of Freedom honors. And the lawsuit argues that how could they be labeled as pornography when we have pretty much all of this, these awards and this proof pointing to that these are great literary works.
Now, this is school libraries only, right? So presumably a student could go to their public library and get one of these books.
They could, yeah. And it isn't just school libraries. It's school grounds, essentially. School provided materials. So a teacher essentially couldn't bring those in or have a classroom library with the books, with the banned books. There is an argument out there that, yeah, they can go to public libraries. They can buy books off Amazon if they want to. However, this lawsuit argues that a school library is sort of this place for students, it's a primary place of information and knowledge and curiosity. And so by taking that, like removing that option from students is detrimental.
Now, I'm not sure if this was part of the discussion at the legislature, but I could imagine an argument for proponents of Utah's current law saying that, Utah might have different collective standards than, say, Louisiana or somewhere else. So we're just protecting our standards.
Sure. And what the lawsuit says is there has always been avenues for parents to prevent their children from reading something. If they do not want their child to read a certain book, there has always been a way for them to contact the school and to prevent their kid from reading something they don't want them to read. Also, before this statewide mechanism went into effect on the local levels under a 2022 law, these decisions were really made by local school boards and were kept at local school boards. Those decisions did not trigger statewide removal. Or just because, the Davis School District decides to ban something doesn't mean that Canyons has to. But now, under the statewide law, that can happen.
Now, there's these best-selling authors. Also, a couple of students, I understand, are part of this lawsuit. What are they saying?
They are saying, essentially, that they want to be able to access materials that address hard subjects. One student, according to the lawsuit, had experienced sexual assault in her freshman year, and she sought out What Girls Are Made Of as a way to help her cope. And she essentially went to her school library, and it wasn't there. And that's that sort of thing can really impact students.
What are any Utah officials responding, school board officials, anybody on the other side responding to this?
I haven't heard or seen anything, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Let me just mention briefly here, you have another story. Utah bans three more books from public schools. One of those is the source for the blockbuster movie Wicked. What are the other books?
Yeah. So just a day before this lawsuit hit, actually, three more books were removed. You mentioned Wicked, 19 Minutes by Jodi Picoult, and The Perks of Being a Wallfire, or I'm sorry, a Wallflower, by Stephen Chbosky. And that was the kind of the source of a pretty popular movie as well, starring Harry Potter's Emma Watson. So that took the number of banned books from 19 to 22. And yeah, it was just three at once. I've been covering every time a book gets removed statewide, I do a story on it. It was the first time, except for when the law went into effect, that multiple books had been banned pretty much the same day. I think it was just due to the, holiday break. So. Mm.
The 19 Minutes is an interesting case. Picoult says that it depicts a school shooting. A perpetrator who had been relentlessly bullied. And Picoult, you say, shared that she's been approached by people who say it was useful for them, young people.
Yeah, on Instagram, she said, the book didn't harm them. It gave them tools to deal with their feelings and their thoughts. She's been pretty vocal, I guess, about book bans across the country. And she said it's upsetting to her. And this is in one of the quotes she provided in an interview with a New Hampshire magazine. She said that a lot of the times her book gets banned because the word erection appears on page 313.
Do we know if that's the specific reason that was banned here in Utah? Do we have any, reasoning?
That reason is that three school districts decided that the material amounted to objective sensitive material. So it doesn't exactly state why, what the reasoning was in terms of what passages they found that met that criteria. Essentially, that's why. I haven't read the book myself, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure this debate will go on. The lawsuit will be going on. You'll be reporting on it. Thank you for telling us about this. One more thing. We have a couple minutes here. Here's the headline. Urgent need. Nearly half of Utah's kindergarten through third grade kids can't read at grade level. It's a new report out. Now, there's some variability here, right? It depends on where you are. You might be at grade level overall, or you might be behind. I guess, is this rich areas, poor areas? Does that have an effect?
This study did look into that. They found that high poverty schools tended to correlate with low proficiency rates, but that wasn't always the case. I mean, essentially, all students can learn to read. It's a matter of resources and how even high poverty schools are applying those resources.
So third grade is key here. Why is third grade so key?
Yeah. So after third grade, you go from learning how to read to reading to learn. So you're expected to absorb information through reading. And if you can't, or if you're, not where you need to be, you can fall behind, and there's studies that show those skills, especially at that age level or lack thereof, have implications to your future, you know, success even as an adult.
I was fascinated. You have a section in here, Utah's looking at Mississippi. They went from like 49th place to 9th place for fourth grade reading over the course of about a decade. What, in brief, what did they do?
They did a lot of things, some of which we have implemented here. So aligning curriculum, just kind of streamlining all of that stuff, and intensive interventions, more training for educators on how to teach reading, essentially, how to teach literacy. And another one of those things is a retention policy. And so in Mississippi, if at the end of third grade you're not reading on grade level, you get held back. You do not advance to fourth grade. And while I haven't seen any bills or proposals about a third grade retention policy in Utah, the governor has flirted with the idea and you know, several news conferences and his literacy summit recently. So we might see it here.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll stay tuned. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Esbitt. Carmen, thank you so much.
Of course.
We're going to head toward a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with reporter Peyton Harkins. Here's the story, Going Without. Here's what more than 120 Utahns taught Peyton about getting by this year. We'll talk about that on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, interesting story. Here's the headline, Going Without. Here's what more than 120 Utahns taught me about getting by this past year. And the me in this case is you, right?
yes, that is me.
So you say in the story that this is the economy, how it's affecting people. That's a regular discussion at the Tribune, right? You get together. It's not just one reporter. It's a bunch of reporters. You get together. And then you did a survey as well.
Yeah, so it was, you know, we put out a series of, you know, Google Forms is what they were, and asking, you know, one of them was just as simple as how are you getting by? We've asked about, you know, what it's like getting jobs, you know, just various things like that to try to just like solicit, you know, a wide swath of, you know, perspectives from our community about how they're dealing with the economy. And, you know, the impetus was this column was that we just got so many responses back, and I wasn't able to contact all these people, but it's like, I wanted them to know that them being so vulnerable with us, like, you know, I did read that, it did have an impact on me, you know, it did shape our coverage. And so that's why I wanted to write this column.
And you did reach out to some people, and you quote them in the story. We'll get to that. But what's mm-hmm. just kind of the overall picture? How are people dealing in general with this economy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, some of the people, you know, told us that they didn't seem to be struggling all that much. I mean, there was that perspective, but I mean, the vast majority of people who filled out this form, I mean, they were struggling. I mean, they were talking about, you know, racking up credit card debt so much that they can no longer afford to pay down that debt. I mean, they were talking about, you know, changes they're making at the grocery store. There was a lot of rumination on, like, you know, we don't eat red meat or beef anymore. You know, we've moved to chicken or turkey or something like that. Just, you know, a lower cost option. There are people that were struggling with, you know, medical expenses. I mean, it ran the gamut. And one person we asked, you know, how are you getting by? And they told us going without. You know, I mean, it was a kind of demoralizing, or at least, you know, you could feel the people's sort of desperation with the situations that they're facing in the responses that we got.
I was interested. There's a quote from your story. A Tooele County reader said they hadn't felt the squeeze of buying groceries, but they felt guilty, so they donated to pay for school lunches.
Yeah, yeah. And there were some, you know, that had a similar sentiment, you know, where, and I don't know that, you know, so many people donated to school lunches or anything, but a lot of people talked about donating to the food banks, you know, and stuff like that to try to help people that, you know, need those services.
So on staying on food, grocery prices increasing, right? And but you mentioned coupons, yes. Sale, food banks, I guess. Food bank usage is sounds like it's up.
Yeah, and I know, you know, one of my colleagues, Jordan Miller, recently did a story about food banks and increased need and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, Utahns are going through it, it seems like. You know, they're having a rough time in this economy.
One, going to the headline, I'll just quote this. When asked what you're doing differently to make ends meet, one reader simply told us, going without. You got to drop, yeah. Got to drop something.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's, you know, some of those people contemplated, you know, we have our kids in this sort of extracurricular activity, you know, we're trying to rearrange our budget so that they can stay in this, you know, activity. But it's like, you know, eventually that's going to probably be one of the things that families have to stop doing, you know, ballet or, I don't know, karate, you know, stuff like that. Like, you know, they've tried to hold on as long as they can, but that sort of stuff is going to be on the chopping block if things don't improve for a lot of people.
And then you you kind of dropped the curtain on your life a little bit. I remember you, I think you're, if I'm quoting you correctly, you said you have to be more strategic about how you eat, how you prepare your meals.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like, you know, it's been a learning process my entire adult life to figure out how to, you know, grocery shop and feed myself and all that stuff, but it's gotten harder. And I've been more reliant on sales and coupons than I've ever been in my, you know, entire life. Like as a single person, you know, it's like my groceries haven't cost so much in the past, but now it's like I find myself, I do a lot of my shopping on the, you know, online, and so I can see all the prices there and I will drop stuff. I'm like, yeah, I'm not gonna pay $7 to $10 for, you know, whatever this is. I think I threw out a frozen pizza the other day because I was like, I could make something way cheaper for $10 than this frozen pizza. You know, it's just It's just different than it has been for me.
One person I said, I think that you need less meat and you go from, you know, red meat to chicken and more stir fry, that kind of thing, yeah. more strategy.
Yeah. And, you know, like for me, I've been using my freezer way more. I, you know, that might seem like a really basic thing to do, but it was like, our family didn't do stuff like that. You know, it's like we didn't make stock or we didn't make meals and then put it in the freezer and we reheat them later. It's like, we always just tried to eat through them. And that's what I've been trying to do. And now it's like, wow, the freezer is a really good tool to help save money. It's like the chicken or whatever that I bought, and made food from or whatever, I can, you know, put its bones in there or whatever, and then make stock from it later. And that's like $3 to $5 I didn't have to spend on stock, you know?
You talked to a lady called Renee Christensen. She had opened their home to renters, but now her son and family had to move in. And that's not atypical.
No, yeah. I did a story with another one of my colleagues, Megan Banta, that was, you know, the sources we got from that story came from these call outs that I'm writing about in this column. And, you know, Renee had reached out to us and told us that, you know, in previously, you know, her family, she said, I think the quote was, had weathered the storm by taking in renters and stuff like that. But then this year, it's like the storm impacted her, you know, grown children as well. And so they had to move back into her house. And this was just a few months after she had retired. She'd been a school bus driver for a long time. And so, you know, not only did she have to, you know, take her son and his family in to help them make ends meet, but she had to go back to work. You know, sure, her retirement got cut short. And now she's driving a bus again.
So you mentioned that this story in the research with Megan Banta. I'll mm-hmm. quote this part from your story. Research shows young adults are now more likely to have completed their education and landed a full-time job than they are to have lived away from their parents. That's pretty striking.
It was striking to me. I almost couldn't believe it. I had to go and look at that study myself just to make sure that we didn't get some words wrong there. But yeah, that's what that study said.
Now, Governor Cox famously mentioned, hey, he was an empty nester, not anymore.
Yeah, you know, his kids are coming back and living, you know, at home with him too. It's just, and that, I think that shows the breadth of the issue or the breadth of the challenges that Utahns are facing, the fact that, no one is immune, including the governor and his children.
You talked about this as well. I guess you were living alone. Now you have a roommate.
No, I have not been able to live
Oh,
alone
you haven't been able to.
my whole
Okay.
time in Utah.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I probably could stretch to afford it, but it's just like I would love to put my money toward anything else, such as groceries or I don't know, I want to go see a movie or something like that. And if I lived alone, I'd have to start thinking about those things way more. So it's like I'm 33 and I have made the choice for the last, I don't know, 5 years to be living with a roommate who I love, by the way. It's not a bad thing, but it's just not the life I really envisioned for myself, And I assume a lot of other people my age and perhaps older and younger are feeling similarly.
You bring in health insurance, how medical emergencies can really knock a family off equilibrium. A man called Brian Harris, so his wife had a recent medical problem, and that's really put them a strain on their family.
Yeah, I mean,
Oh.
she was diagnosed with some pretty serious, conditions that required surgery and stuff like that. And, like so many sort of young, healthy people, they were on a high deductible insurance plan, and then they had to, it just ended up being like the price of medical, having to pay those deductibles up to a certain point and stuff like that. I mean, they're just kind of hemorrhaging money at this point. She had to quit her job, so she lost her health insurance, so it all went on his. His kids were on his too, and it's just like I don't know. He told me that they feel like they did back when they were first married, and he was working part time, and they were getting by on tips, But now they're a whole, a husband and wife and kids, and that's just not. I don't know. That's just, it doesn't feel sustainable to me.
You also talk about unemployment, trying to find a job. Anecdotally, talking to friends, they tell me it's a lot harder these days, and that sounds like that's what people are telling you.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying things like it's been the most frustrating and degrading thing I've ever gone to. Like, people are applying to jobs en masse, tens. If not, some people were telling me 100 jobs every month or every so often, and they're just not, it seems like their applications are just going into the void, falling into a trash can or something because nobody is getting back to them. And it's, I mean, when you can't find work, like, yeah, you could just kind of again feel like that desperation coming through in some of these. And I actually, I talked about some of these people in this column, but I'm planning to do a, kind of larger story looking at the issue of jobs right now. So I'll return to this issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say about the story?
Oh, I mean, I just think, I mean, the message that I ended with in the story was just this idea of like, we're all in this together, Like that's what Renee Christensen's family taught me. When times got hard, they, huddled together under one roof because they had to, and they're going to get by. And I think that like we as, Utahns, us as, members of our community or whatever, I think that one, talking about this stuff makes it easier, makes you feel less alone. And then two, just, trying to weather this storm together. I mean, show kindness to each other, take care of each other, do what we can to get through these hard times.
Yeah, impactful story. I'm sure you'll be reporting on this as we go forward. I wanted to fit just a little couple minutes in on this one. Interesting. Here's the headline. In Utah, here's why experts say it took nearly 130 years for any bars to unionize in Utah. And so we do have a bar that did recently unionize. Tell me about this.
Yes, that's the Sun Trap, which also, has made history as being Utah's oldest and longest running gay bar. And yeah, they started the process of unionizing this fall. But I, this story kind of, is a bit of a, I don't know, maybe a retrospective on that starting point. It talks about how, okay, they started this process of unionizing in September, but really, like, the challenges that they faced trying to unionize in Utah go back to, pre-statehood, basically, the anti-organized labor sentiments that exist in a state that leads to Utah having such a low rate of unionized labor. I mean, the origins of that, far out just the Sun Trap. And so I tried to get into some of that and just kind of set the scene for like, this historic milestone was, quite historic.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the story, we go way back. Joe Hill, famous Joe Hill, was executed in Utah, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Joe Hill, and even before then to pre-statehood, you know, some of the early union workers in Utah were Latter-day Saint pioneers, you know, and then at some point there became a split there, and then we kind of get to where we're at today. But yeah, I didn't expect to go back that far, but that's where the reporting took me.
Mm-hmm. I guess the person behind the unionization of Suntrap came from Las Vegas. They were saying Las Vegas is so much better in terms of, from their point of view, for unionization.
Yeah, I mean, she was just talking to me about, you know, there's higher starting wages, there's, you know, benefits, there's scheduling security, you know, and stuff like that. But and partly it's just because, you know, the service industry in Vegas is so much larger, their labor unions are more established, all that stuff. But she came to Salt Lake and she was just kind of shocked by the job she was being offered and the conditions of those jobs. And then, you know, bounced around to a few places from my understanding, and then, you know, settled at the Suntrap and decided, you know, enough was enough for her, and she wanted to unionize it. And then, yeah, started that process.
And you point out in the story that it's a little harder to unionize if, in the service industry, right? Shifts don't overlap a lot of times. If you're on the factory floor, you're all together, but you might have a smaller staff and not overlapping, so harder to communicate.
Yeah, and that's kind of, it's interesting because, I mean, those were, you know, kind of historically the challenges to unionize in the service industry. But, you know, the proliferation of, you know, social media use and all that stuff has kind of made, you know, maybe you can't see each other at work, but you can, you know, make an Instagram or something like that and find out if your colleagues are supportive that way. You know, and that's a lot of what Suntrap did, from my understanding. I mean, they have an Instagram that I've seen, you know, them post stuff on. So
this same person who was successful in the Suntrap, they say they're going to try at other places. I guess at least they're going to try.
Yeah, they're going to, you know, it's sort of, I guess, like an advisory role. You know, if other, you know, bar and restaurant workers have questions about it, they've posted on their social media that, you know, reach out to me if you have questions. You know, I'll give you a, you know, some ideas of what you can do and how you can do it and all that stuff. And she told me, I followed up with her. I talked to her, you know, the day Suntrap unionized, actually in late November. And then I followed up about a month later just to see how it was going, you know, if she'd heard from any other, you know, restaurant and bar workers about wanting to unionize. And she said she'd heard from a few. So,
yeah,
you know, we might, you know, Suntrap is the first, but it might not be the last. So.
All right. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on that. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And we'll continue after a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Here's the headline we'll be talking about after the break. The Great Salt Lake enters 2026 uncomfortably close to record lows. We'll be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you for joining us.
You bet. It's nice to be here.
Good to be here. I want to talk about the Great Salt Lake. Here's the headline. The Great Salt Lake enters 2026 uncomfortably close to record lows. First line of your story, Great Salt Lake rang in 2026 in pretty rough shape. So how rough?
Well, I was just looking at the elevation data this morning. It's at 4,191.7 feet above sea level. And to put that into context, the record low elevation that we hit at the end of 2022 was 4,188.5 feet. So we're just barely 3 feet hovering above that. And the Great Salt Lake typically loses about 3 feet a year to evaporation. So if we don't get that lake refilling pronto, we could very well see ourselves at another record low in the very near future.
Now, it's been a rainy fall and winter so far. I guess that doesn't help as much as snow.
No, I mean, yes, it has been very rainy. I wish it would freeze and turn to snow. I mean, just looking at, again, the latest data on the Great Salt Lake, like I said, it's 4,191.6 feet above sea level. And just a month ago, it was 4,191.3 feet above sea level. So even with all that rain we've seen the last few weeks, it is a fraction of a foot that raised the lake. What it really needs is that snowpack accumulating in the mountains then melting off into the surge in the spring that makes its way to those tributary rivers and then helps the lake rise. We can watch that cycle year by year. It kind of swells in the spring and early summer, and then as evaporation kicks off, it will drop and drop and drop until things cool off around late fall, winter, and then the cycle repeats. So it's kind of it's like lungs breathing in and out if you look at the elevation every year.
No, I'm looking at the map here in your story of the snowpack. Looks like where I'm talking to you from in extreme northern Utah, we're doing great, not so great in many other areas.
Well, and I wouldn't say northern Utah's doing great. It's doing about average.
Okay, right? 104% of average. That's true, yes.
Yeah, it's about normal.
Average. We're doing average, yes.
Which is great, yes. I mean, I don't want to be dismissive about that, but we definitely need to be above average to get the lake to start its, you know, an upward trajectory instead of this long-term, decades-long-term trend of decline, decline, decline. So while average is good, we need many years of above average to even start making a blip of a difference. And to your point, I initially wrote the story for our Open Lands newsletter late last week, and the Bear River drainage where you're at, Tom, was actually not, it was below average, just like every other basin in the state. So it was just those storms over the weekend that kind of kicked it up.
Mm-hmm.
So
what area?
That's kind of, you know, we're just teetering on these, you know, the brink, it seems like, every storm. So
what area kind of verging over to western Utah, 19% in red. Other areas, 59% in the 50s, right? So not where we need to be.
I know. I mean, things are bad in the Great Salt Lake Basin, but they're really bad in southern Utah, really bad. We got the severe watershed, which is kind of like the Great Salt Lake in that it's terminal, never flows to the sea, never goes to the ocean. It's terminal. It has a terminal lake called Severe Dry Lake, and it's not doing great. To your point, southern Utah, the Colorado River watershed, also below average, not looking great. So it's just tough statewide.
You talked to Bonnie Baxter at Westminster University's Great Salt Lake Institute. She says it's terrifying just how close we are to breaking the historic low. So we're, what, a couple of feet above the historic low at this point?
Yep, just about three. And again, like I said, it loses three every summer pretty much. So unless we replenish that lake, we could very well topple over into another record low soon. But to your point about Bonnie Baxter, she's a great source because she's always out on the lake, boots on the ground. She studies the microbialites that grow out there. They're kind of these microorganism communities that pull minerals out of the salty water and build rock formations. They're very cool. Sometimes people call it like the coral of the Great Salt Lake, although it's not really a coral, but kind of the same idea. It's like the keystone or foundation for our ecosystem, because the brine flies that birds love so much really depend on these microbialites. They use them as an anchoring point to lay eggs and make babies. And I think even the brine shrimp might use them for like oxygenation purposes. So they're very important. And that's something that Bonnie Baxter studies. And with the lake being so low, they're surfacing, they're high and dry, which means they die off, which is not great for the lake either. So
I guess
pretty bad out there. And she knows because she's out there all the time looking.
One bit of, I guess, silver lining, the salinity level is a little better than it has been. I guess that's because we've been manipulating the causeway.
Yeah, I think there's a bright spot to all of this. That's it. It's the causeway. I know it's unsettling to think about chopping the lake in half so that at least half of it can remain ecologically viable, but that is what has pretty much kept the Great Salt Lake ecosystem from completely collapsing, especially during that 2022 period when it hit its record low. All the brine flies were disappearing, which had people really nervous about what that meant for the next migratory bird season that was coming in the spring. People were really on edge. And so, yes, you're right. They filled in this breach through that rock-filled railroad causeway that bisects the lake from Promontory Point out to the West Desert. It's what makes the lake two colors. If you look at a Google aerial image or something, you might notice that the north is like pink-purple, the south is blue-green. It's because of that causeway. So that was built in the 50s. It used to be a wooden trestle, so the water could freely pass underneath that railroad spur, but wood and salt water famously don't really get along that well. So the rail company went through in the 50s and filled it in with rocks. But it opened up two breaches, kind of like a bridge, so the water could still pass through from north to south. And what they did back in 2022, when things were not looking great, is they filled rocks, just used like a backhoe, to dump rocks into that breach and raise it up so that the water could no longer pass through to the north. And what that essentially did, or effectively did, is it turned the north into like a salt suck. So all the salt migrated north into the hypersaline north arm that's pink purple, and it kept the salinity from spiking the south. So that's a big lesson that resource managers learned over the last few years, and something they're preparing to do again as things are not looking great because, there's a Great Salt Lake that's shrinking causes all kinds of problems, but at least with managing salinity in the south, you can keep some of those ecosystem functions healthy. So,
Now, one big problem with a shrinking lake is you have, all of that now dry land,
yeah.
and dust. And this is not just any dust, right?
Right. I think this is probably what gives most Utahns the most anxiety about a shrinking Great Salt Lake. We all love the birds, we all love the brine shrimp, but even if you never go to the Great Salt Lake or dip your toe in the water, you are probably, if you live on the Wasatch Front at least, breathing in the dust, blowing off that drying lake bed. And you're right, Tom, no dust is good for anybody to be breathing in, but the Great Salt Lake has stuff in its lake bed that's potentially even more alarming for public health. We've got things like arsenic that we know is in the lake bed, heavy metals. We have a long history of mining in this state, in this region, and a lot of that's, the Great Salt Lake being the lowest point in the valley, things just settle in there into the lake bed. So when the dust kicks up, there's stuff in there, and we don't fully understand the extent of that problem or the impact it's having on people, but it is something that the state is looking into studying and understanding better.
What are your, I want to move to another story, not just for farms. New report shows where water from the shrinking Great Salt Lake is going. But I'm not sure which story it was, and I may have got this wrong, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. Somebody said no one has successfully reversed shrinkage of a saline lake.
Oh yeah, you're correct. That's
Okay.
true. That's common knowledge. We've seen Great Salt Lakes shrink all around the world, from the Aral Sea in Central Asia to Lake Urmia in Iran. We have Owens Lake in California, Mono Lake in California, Salton Sea, all these saline lakes all around the world. Once they start this trend of decline, like we're seeing with the Great Salt Lake, no human population, no community has ever reversed that trend. Some have tried. I think Mono Lake is a really great example in California, but they just have never got there. They haven't reversed the decline. So Utah thinks it can be the first lake or the first community to do that for a salty lake. But I think our challenges are just so much more widespread than a place like Mono Lake. Because if you think about Mono Lake in California, there was only one water user. It was a city of Los Angeles that built this big pipeline up to Mono Lake and essentially stuck a straw into its watershed and started sucking it dry and piping it down south to the city. So at least in that point, that case, you can point to one water user and say, "Hey, you're responsible for this, and you need to cut it out." But here in the Great Salt Lake watershed, everybody is playing a role. So it's just so much more complicated. It's so much bigger. But the state has really said it's dedicated to this. In fact, they want to send the lake on an upward trajectory in time for the Olympics in 2034. So time will tell, I suppose. But
Yeah.
things aren't looking great so far.
Yeah, we've got less than 10 years. So the report you're referring to in this story is the Great Salt Lake Strike Team released its annual report. So just very briefly, we just have a couple minutes on this. I guess good news about farmers, maybe not using as much, but I guess cities are using more than we thought.
Yeah, anecdotally, I've been reporting on the Great Salt Lake for years, more than a decade. And just anecdotally, when you go out and talk to farmers, because they're always the ones that people point their fingers to, right? Like, oh, if you stop growing all this alfalfa, then the Great Salt Lake wouldn't shrink. At least that's what you hear from people living in cities. But when you talk to farmers, they're just like looking around. They're like, all the farmland around me is getting gobbled up by subdivisions. I've reduced my water use substantially. I've changed the way I do business. And like, yet the state keeps saying our water use has held steady over the decades. It just doesn't make sense. So this latest strike team report seems to bear that out. I think in the past they said cities use like 16 or 17% of water in the Great Salt Lake watershed, but now that they've recalculated, things haven't changed. They just recalculated, reassessed the numbers. And it looks like cities are contributing closer to 26% of depletions of water in the watershed. And that takes agriculture, I think, down from like they calculated around 72, 75% last year. Now it's down closer to 65%. So I think the message that policymakers are trying to get out there with these new findings is that we all truly do have a role to play, including city dwellers. We all need to make sacrifices and cut back on our water consumption if we want this lake to recover.
What are officials saying? Are they? I think they're probably trying to project optimism. It's you know, it's kind of a blow that we had these two huge water years, and now we're kind of right back to the problem.
Right. I know. I mean, that just shows you the scale of the problem, right? Like, we had the biggest snowpack we've ever seen, since the Mormon pioneers showed up and settled the Salt Lake Valley, like the biggest snowpack we've ever seen in 2023. It barely made a blip. Like, here we are teetering right back to where we were right before that big snowpack. Like, it just shows you the scale and like immensity of this problem here. Yeah, but to your point, state leaders are optimistic. They started this Great Salt Lake Rising initiative, got hundreds of millions of dollars from nonprofits and the private sector. But, money doesn't exactly equal water. Like, you have to have water users, water right holders are willing to exchange their water for that money. And so far, while that's been a little bit successful, it has not been nearly enough to move the dial.
Well, thank you for telling us about this. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this as we go forward.
Yeah, anytime.
Yeah. Water and Land Use reporter Leah Larson. Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. We'll turn first to Carmen Nesbitt. What's your underplayed story?
I would like to highlight my colleague's Courtney Tanner's story on a possible vineyard that is coming to, or possibly coming to, Utah State University.
And that's in St. George area, I think. Yeah, that's an interesting story. Yeah, I read that one. Thanks for highlighting that one. SLTrib.com for that one. Peyton Harkins, what's your underplayed story?
Okay, I've been going back and forth on this. I think I'm gonna highlight a story by Andy Larson. He, of course, writes about the Utah Jazz. He wrote a story today about Cody Williams, one of their draft prospects a couple of years ago, who was supposed to be really good, also the brother of Jalen Williams on the Oklahoma City Thunder, who I adore. And he's just talking about Cody Williams kind of going back to basics, doing high school sort of level drills so that he can find a role for himself as an NBA player. And I thought it was a interesting sort of story of the Utah Jazz trying to rebuild.
All right, check that one out at SLTrib.com. And Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story?
So mine's probably not that underplayed because it initially ran in the New York Times, but for their travel series, they came out to Park City and did like 36 hours in Park City, which is really cool that, our one of our ski towns is getting the national spotlight. But man, what a dismal year to take a ski vacation in Utah.
Yeah, the
So
snow isn't great, at least
I
so far.
know. Hopefully it
Yeah.
gives Park City a little bit of a boost. And they highlighted things beyond skiing, like the Homestead Crater and stuff. But man, like, what timing? What timing?
Yeah. SLTrib.com for that one as well. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And we have been joined today by Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Reporter Peyton Harkins has been with us. Thanks, Peyton.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And Water and Land Use reporter Leah Larson has been with us. Thank you, Leah.
Yep, happy weekend, everybody.
Happy weekend. Thanks, everybody. And I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me for Behind the Headlines again next time. Thanks, everybody.